Welcome to the Ex-Good Girl podcast. What is an ex-good girl? Someone who has decided to stop making other people comfortable at her own expense, to stop abandoning what she wants for her life out of fear of what other people will think, and to stop pretending that everything is fine when it's not. If you're a woman who feels exhausted by constant people-pleasing and perfectionism, and you're ready to stop but you just don't know how, you're in the right place. I'm Sarah Bybee-Fisk, the Stop People-Pleasing Coach, and I will teach you what you need to know to get out of that constant cycle of doubt, guilt, and resentment, and into a life that feels powerful and free. Enjoy the episode. You are listening to the Ex-Good Girl podcast, episode 53. Tori Lynn, I am excited to jump in because not only do I think you're an amazing person, I love the way your brain works. I love, love, love the times that you have coached me. You've always helped me to see something that wasn't part of what I thought the problem was, that always ended up like helping me see it in a completely different way. And so this is just such a treat for me. And I know for the people who listen to my podcast, they're going to love it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I am very delighted to be here. I love all the conversations we have, and it feels like such a treat for everyone that like they can share in it now, because I think we have some of the best conversations.
I agree. Tell everyone who you are and what you do.
Okay. I am Tori Lynn, the host of the Satisfied AF podcast. I'm a career and life coach, and I coach people on all kinds of areas of their life, from relationships to building businesses. My specialty started out as career, but what I really found was the way people are showing up in any area of their lives can impact all the others. And so I quickly became an everything coach, because like I'd be coaching someone about work and work stress. And then it would turn out part of work stress was that people leave chocolates in like the kitchen at work. And that was like a stressful interaction. So then we coached about the chocolates. And I just really love getting to support people in that holistic way in every area of their lives. And what I really help people do is enjoy their lives more and get more of what they want. And I love to help people specifically go after their goals in a way that feels fun and sustainable, because I see so many people going after their goals in a way that feels like grueling and like crawling across a hot desert. And I just don't think we have to do it that way. And I think it's a lot more fun and again, sustainable to make it enjoyable and doable.
Well, we're recording this in January. And so this is the New Year's resolution time of the year. Do you do New Year's resolutions? Tell me what you do.
I don't really like to be governed by the calendar. I think I have my own rhythms and seasons. And like this year, for instance, I got COVID over the holidays and I got really, really sick. So I absolutely was not thinking about like setting myself up for success and like resolutions. Like on January 1, I was just trying to like breathe through my nose and get 12 hours of sleep a night. And now that I've been healing and feeling better for a little bit, few weeks, now I'm starting to get excited about like, what do I want 2024 to be like? But I think like it ebbs and flows of like when I'm interested in setting goals and like deciding where I'm going and marching forward. And when I'm like, you know what, I think I just need some quiet reflection. I need to reevaluate. I need to see like, where am I and how did I get here before I think about where I want to go next?
I love that. I do love the energy of like a new year. And I realize, you know, that's a lot of, you know, programming and the way I've been taught to think about it, but it works for me to kind of take the time to look ahead. Like you said, what do I want 2024 to be? How can I make some intentional decisions around that? The conversation that I wanted to have with you today is about imposter syndrome, because it comes up inevitably in every single conversation that I have with people who I coach, which are people socialized as women in this kind of patriarchal capitalist Western thing we got going on here. And you have just said some things, I've read some things that you have written from your own work and the work of others that really have like literally made me stop thinking about it. and realize that I have been unwittingly participating in kind of this interplay between imposter syndrome and goal setting. Because oftentimes when you have someone come in who wants coaching around, you know, goal setting, career path, advancement, success, they want to get quote unquote better. They want to they want to make progress and they want to be rewarded for that in terms of career. And they're deeply afraid of being found out for, you know, that they're not as qualified as they think they should be, or there's this ideal that they keep beating themselves up with. And so let's fix that right now. Okay. Let's just fix it for women everywhere. People socialize as women. Okay. Can we do that?
I mean, we can try. So yeah, I talk about this a lot with my clients too. I probably have at least one podcast episode on it. But I think imposter syndrome is so interesting because I think specifically people with marginalized identities, and being socialized as a girl or woman is a marginalized identity. It's the only marginalized identity where you're actually not a minority, which I think is really interesting to think about. But people socialized as girls and women are literally trained, in my opinion, to have imposter syndrome because we're socialized differently than people who are socialized as boys and men. We're socialized to second guess ourselves. We're socialized to be polite. We're socialized not to brag. We're socialized to be demure and like all these things that I think it's like a pipeline, right? It's like the socialized as a girl or woman pipeline to, you know, having imposter syndrome. And like, I know this podcast and your clients are people socialized as girls and women. But I think it's worth saying that also the other marginalized identities. So, because if you're socialized as a girl or woman and you also identify, like if you're also Black, if you're also Indigenous, if you're also a person of color, if you're queer, right? If you're an immigrant without money,
yeah.
If you're an immigrant, right? If you do not belong to the dominant, like, identity in any way, and especially if you have these overlapping marginalized identities, you can be socialized the kind of multiple times in this direction. Like, you have to be better than everyone else in order to be able to be in that room because you don't look like all the people in that room. You have to be beyond reproach. Right. And even as I say this, like, I'm getting like chills in my body, which is not something that normally happens when I talk. It usually happens when other people talk. But like, some of these are so in our collective consciousness of we've heard it over and over and over again. Like, we are not afforded the same things as cishet white men. Right. And so, of course, a lot of us have imposter syndrome. Of course, we're like in a meeting going, who am I to say this thing? Of course, we're laying awake at night wondering, like, if we're going to be found out for being a fraud. What I also think is so interesting about this is, again and again, when I coach people who have this, I'm like, well, did you lie about your background and experience? And they're like, no. And I'm like, okay, so it's really interesting though, then, that you were honest about what your experience is. Like, yes, you have a law degree. Yes, you worked at another organization for 5 years. And yet, even though you told the truth, you still think somehow you fooled everyone into thinking you're someone you're not, right? So like, when you look at the facts, it's kind of like, wait a minute, that doesn't check out. But because it's that socialization piece, right? It's this, and socialization is a habit of the mind, right? You're in this mind habit where now you're marginalizing yourself from the inside because that's what you were taught to do. And you won't even realize it, right? You'll be like, oh, this is just how normal people think. And because half of the world is socialized as girls and women, it is how normal people think, but like, that's not necessarily useful for you, right? So I think kind of just coming to understand that, like, oh, of course I feel this way. This isn't evidence that something's wrong with me. It's evidence that something happened to me. Because to be socialized is to have something happen to you. It's to have other people teach you and shape you. And sometimes it's like your parents and teachers, but sometimes it's also like not exactly a person. It's what movies did you watch? It's what TV shows? It's what books did you read? And how did those shape your view of the world and your place in it and what you're allowed to have and what you're not allowed to have?
And that is why I love Corey Lynn, because I mean, I don't want to end it there because I actually have a lot of things I want to go back and kind of dig deeper into. But that was just a brilliant, beautiful summary of what I'm hoping that I can understand on a deeper level, and that people can understand, that we end up discounting ourselves, marginalizing ourselves because of what has happened to us. And so we create in some ways this thing that we think is happening to us. We participate in perpetuating it. We didn't create it, right? We didn't create the system that has done this. And I want to talk specifically about that. But what I love is that coaching is all about finding the place where you have power, the power to make it different. And in looking at the socialization of our minds and how we just have been taught to think, that is the place where we have the power. Let's back up for just a second first, because I want to get a good working definition for people who might be hearing this term. They understand it, but they're not quite, they've heard it, but they don't maybe quite understand it. Marginalized. Can you give us a good identity or a definition of what marginalized means?
So we live in a culture that has certain identities that are kind of seen as the default, right? That would be considered the dominant identity. And if you're not aware of this, listeners, that's okay, because until someone teaches you about this, you wouldn't know, because that's sort of how the system is designed. The system is designed to cater to certain identities, but it almost seems invisible until
and it wants to hide that. Yes.
Right. But once you learn to see it, it's everywhere. Right. Okay. So like, just to go over some for like American culture, because I'm not an expert in all the cultures in the world. In American culture, the dominant identity is male. The female identity is the marginalized identity, because our culture was not designed with women in mind. It was designed with men in mind. And like, we didn't even have the right to vote until what, 1920? And the right to vote is an interesting one, because like, the right to vote is, you can see like who it was originally for. Who was the culture originally for? It was originally for like white male landowners, right? So white is the dominant identity in American culture. Let's see, able-bodied or able-minded is the dominant culture, whereas disabled is the marginalized identity. Cisgender is the dominant identity, whereas transgender is the marginalized identity. And like, I want to be clear, like, I'm not the one saying like these are less than, they're not less than, but culturally, the way the country works, the way the culture works, it orients towards and caters to the dominant cultures. In American culture, Christianity is the religion that is considered like the dominant religion, and other religions, or, you know, lack of religion, like being an atheist or agnostic, those are, you know, the non-dominant, the marginalized groups. Let's see. Heterosexuality is the dominant in this culture. And you can see like, queer people didn't even have the right to get married until extremely recently, because they are a marginalized group who was not afforded the same rights. Now, I think it's also worth saying that sometimes groups are afforded the same rights, and that doesn't mean that they're now the dominant group. That just means they have been brought into like some amount of access to things, but sometimes those groups can come into and out of access because they're not the dominant group that the culture caters to. And there's like lots of ones that I haven't talked about. Like wealth is another way. And like, what we're really talking about here too is also privilege. And I know that's a touchy term for some people, but all privilege means is you don't have to face certain obstacles. Privilege doesn't mean things are necessarily super easy for you. It means there are obstacles someone else is facing that you don't have to face because of one of your identities. I'm a white woman, so there are obstacles I've just never had to face and probably didn't even know about because of my whiteness. I'm also a woman, right? So there are obstacles I have faced that like a man might had not have known about or even considered, right? So we, all of us are constellations of identities, and usually some of our identities may be that dominant / privileged identity, and some of our identities may be that marginalized identity. I'm also queer, right? So that's also an identity that I have. And I didn't realize I was queer for a long time, which, because we have this thing called compulsory heteronormativity, which is basically the idea that everyone is treated straight until if they come to their own conclusion of like, wait a minute, no, I'm not. And that socialization is so strong that even when I had sex with women, I was like, oh, I'm just straight. But like, there's this like whole cultural narrative of like, you're doing it for attention or, you know, these kinds of things. So I was like, oh, I'm obviously straight, but like, I'm adventurous, which is like so embarrassing now because it was like so obvious. But to claim the queer identity felt really scary to me. And also like, maybe I'm not allowed, right, to have that, you know, so that, but that's an example where I transitioned from believing I belonged to the dominant group to realizing I didn't. And that really impacted like certain areas of the country. Like I remember going to a small town in Washington and it was like the first road trip I was on with my girlfriend. And she's masculine of center. And so she very much does not look like a straight person, whereas I'm a femme, so I could pass if I needed to. Mm-hmm. And I felt so unsafe, and that had never happened to me in a way that had to do with sexual orientation. Now, because I am a woman, I had gone to other places and also felt unsafe in a, you know, physical safety way, but never for that reason. And so that was really interesting where like, it's that privilege is, it's invisible. When you belong to the dominant culture, you don't realize you're not facing obstacles because you're also facing some other obstacles because you're still living life as a human, which has a lot of, you know, things that go wrong and obstacles and stuff. Right. So like losing the access to that was really stark for me because I like felt it happen because that also happened in my 30s when I was really aware and I'd lived this whole adult life already. So I'm a bit of a tangent talker, listeners. So my apologies / you're welcome. Does that answer your question, Sarah? Are there more things in there you want to dig into?
No, I that is a fantastic answer. And I think what I wanted is for people to understand that marginalized beings, it just wasn't built for you. It wasn't built with you in mind. And so you get to participate in the system, but you're constantly running into all the ways in which it wasn't built for you, the ways in which you have to fight for access, equality, and how even once you get access and equality, that still doesn't mean it was built for you.
And the ways in which there may be implicit or explicit pressure for you to conform to the thing the way it is, which you may sense in your body and mind as imposter syndrome as well. It's that like round peg square hole, like, oh, this was not designed for me. Ergo, am I actually allowed to be here?
Yeah. And then how do I go ahead? You,
I was just gonna say, like, I think often like when you are able to get into those spaces, you're also able to bring like really brilliant, interesting, beautiful ideas because you're thinking differently and you have different lived experiences. Like if everyone in that room has the same lived experiences or very similar lived experiences, then like what they're able to come up with creatively is going to be limited. So I think like we need more like diversity so that people have like more creativity and more interesting ideas. So like, if you want to be in those rooms, I want you to be in those rooms and I want to help you get there, but I also want to help you have a more pleasurable experience of being in those rooms and a less tortured one, because that constant imposter syndrome can feel like torture.
And it can keep a lot of people from even venturing into those rooms, right? Because they discount and take themselves out before they even get there. So
I want to say something else about that before.
Please do. Yes.
Okay. Cause what I want to say is, and like, if you don't want to be in those rooms, that's also okay. Like what I also want to say is you can build your own rooms. Cause I know sometimes to be in a room that wasn't built for you can be extremely stressful. So just because you could add value doesn't mean you should, or you have to, but if you go into that room and you feel that pressure and it feels off and it makes you question yourself, and then like, you walk away less confident, then I also think you're less likely to go build your own room because your confidence has been knocked down. You have that, like, who the fuck am I to do this? Oh, are we allowed to say the F word?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Like who am I? Right. Whereas if you go in and you're like, oh, this wasn't built for me, their loss, like then you can maintain more of your sense of confidence and your sense of capability and go build a different room. So overcoming imposter syndrome is not about being able to stay in a system that you don't like being in, that doesn't feel good to you. It's not about assimilating, right? But it's about understanding why you feel uncomfortable there and then just making the choice for yourself of like, do I want to create comfort for myself there? Because for some reason, it feels important for me to be there. And like, I'm very practical, right? So that could be like, I really want to keep this health insurance. Or that could be like, I really want to make a change from the inside of this organization. Or you could be like, oh, I'm going to make a change, but I'm not doing it over here because being in that space is not worth the cost that I'm bearing, right? So it's like, I want you more to like have the possibility to do whatever it is you want. But understanding why certain things may bring up insecurity, imposter syndrome, and all these like really painful feelings.
Yeah. I love the differentiation between having the skills to make the choice to either stay in a system that was not built for you and navigate it for reasons that you really like and that are valuable for you, or to leave and create a different space, belong to a different system, because that is what works better for you. Mm-hmm. How, and actually, here's what I want to do. I read something that you wrote, and I'm just going to kind of summarize it probably badly. And I want you to give me your thoughts and just kind of take it from there. So sure. What you wrote was that what you have noticed or have in the work that you do, imposter syndrome points the finger at individuals and burdens them with being better, with improving. You can see my fingers are, you know, making air quotes if you can't if you can't hear that in my voice. It burdens the individual, the marginalized individual, with changing so that they can fit the system without criticizing the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And we see this a lot because American culture, Western culture, is very individual oriented. And so if you, the individual, are experiencing something, the culture often puts the onus on you to fix it. Like, oh, you're feeling imposter syndrome, you should talk to a therapist or a coach. Now, listen, nothing wrong with talking to a therapist or a coach. I am a coach. I talk to a therapist and other coaches. Those are great, but it's putting the pressure on the individual when the problem is actually systemic, right? And this is about imposter syndrome, but it's also about all kinds of other things. It's about burnout culture, right? It's about like, oh, you're super stressed at work. Like, instead of changing the structures of work and organization and like flexible blah, 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 and like 30-hour work week, we're just going to be like, you should do something about that, right? So I think there is a way in which systems put pressure on individuals to conform, but they call it like, you do some self-care and then come back so you can work in the system, when a lot of times the system needs to change. Now, listeners, you may be like surprised to hear me say that, because I'm a coach who does work with people individually. And the reason for that is because like life is complex, and sometimes we're not able to change the system and we're not able to leave the system. And so we are going to go out and do the thing that's going to help us cope, which maybe is to get a coach, maybe it's to get a therapist, maybe it's to get a coach who's going to then help us launch a business so we can leave this job. Maybe it's like, we're going to get a different job. But a lot of my clients, actually, what they do is they learn to change change how they interact with the system in a different way that then helps them like either be able to tolerate the system for longer until they can make a move that feels good. Or sometimes they can even change the system, or they can start a business with different systems in it. But just because we understand that the system needs to change doesn't mean it's necessarily going to as fast as we want it to, or in the ways we want it to. But I think it is important. Also, it's just like understanding, oh, I feel imposter syndrome because I was literally trained to think this way about myself. Maybe I'd like to change the way the culture trains girls and women, but I also have to do something about the socialization in my head now. So if you're in a workplace culture where like they're putting the onus on you to fix like your stress or whatever, you may take actions to address that. But I also don't want you to take responsibility like for what's actually not yours to take responsibility for. Because I see this a lot where people try to control the things they can't control and take responsibility for those, but then also sometimes don't want to take responsibility for or control the things they can control. And I just think it's really helpful if we get clear on where our power is and use it there, even if like there's other things at play that maybe need to change as well. We might not be able to change them at the exact moment. Does that make sense?
It does. And that's exactly kind of what I wanted to narrow down to. So within these systems that were not created for people socialized as women, people socialized, you know, well, as women who inhabit other identities, even though these systems were not created for us, here we are. And we have to learn how to, I think the goal of coaching and the goal of your coaching and mine is, here we are, how do we learn to have a better experience being here, where we can take responsibility for what we are actually able to change and then leave what we are not able to change in ways that we are happy with. So where do you start to unwind something like imposter syndrome?
Oh, where do you start to unwind? I mean, I'm a fan, the kind of coaching I do is anytime someone comes to me with something, I'm like, give me an example, and whatever example they give me, that's where I'm going to begin to unwind it. And I kind of see it like, I am a sometimes knitter. So like recently I haven't been knitting, but I do know how to knit. And sometimes your yarn gets really, really tangled. And when your yarn gets really, really tangled, you just start somewhere. Now, if you can find the little one of the ends of the yarn, that's a great place to start, because then you can kind of like wind it into a new ball as you're like untangling the knot. But sometimes you just have a mess and you just start picking and pulling on the threads and you're like, this actually happened the other day because I was untying my shoes, but it didn't work the way it's supposed to. And it became a big knot instead. And then I didn't know like what was not working. I was just like, well, it's not working. So I just began to pick and pull until something happened. And then I was able to like figure out how to untangle it. And so that's how I start all of my coaching, right? A client will come to me and they'll be like, I feel imposter syndrome. I want to drink less. I want to like my significant other again. You want to stop yelling at my kids. And then I'll just be like, give me an example. And then we'll just begin to pick and pull apart, like what's actually happening here. What I love about coaching is it's often a little bit different. Like I, as the coach may have a guess. I'm like, maybe it's this. And then like we untangle it. And sometimes I'm like, it absolutely wasn't that, right? That's so fun and interesting. Like from the point of view of like being a practitioner, it's fun and interesting. I think sometimes when it's your situation, it can be less fun and interesting. I will admit that. And Sarah has coached me, so she's seen me be like, this is neither fun nor interesting. But I think imposter syndrome in a lot of ways, like how to unwind it is really about seeing like, what are the perspectives I'm holding to be true about myself? And like, why am I doing that? And what am I afraid would happen if I was like treated myself well and was confident? And like, what are the triggers that are like kind of like the stressful situations or the interactions with other people that are bringing up these insecurities? And kind of like piecing together, like what's the picture of what's going on now? And then getting into like, how do we want it to be? And then how do we bridge that gap? Cause I think that's what coaching really is about. Whenever you're coaching about anything, it's like, where are we now? Where do we want to go? And then how do we bridge that gap? And then usually in the bridging of the gap, there's a bunch of obstacles that you don't even know about ahead of time. And then you just one by one, as they arise, you figure out how to do it. And that I think is why I see it like untangling yarn, because I don't know what I'm going to be doing 3 steps from now. I just have faith that if I keep doing what I know how to do, we will get to the other side. We will get an untangled piece of yarn. We will move through. Does that?
Yes, it does. Brilliant. And I think what I love about it is that I have the same experience in that I know the basic landscape of like learning to not people please anymore, learning to leave perfectionism behind. But it is always a different kind of journey with different obstacles for each person. One of the places that I think is essential to start, because I was so blind to it. You and I have talked about how we, you know, kind of grew up on different ends of the religious spectrum. I grew up very religious. You grew up not at all, you know, religious. And although you did have, you know, you've had some experiences with religion, it was like, you said it so simply, like I was literally trained to think this way. Mm-hmm. And when I saw, I was trained to doubt myself constantly, to look outside of myself for confirmation that I was doing it right, that I was trained to be polite, to be kind, to acquiesce, to be humble. I mean, I keep bringing this book up in every podcast because I just can't get it out of my brain. Elise Lunin, On Our Best Behavior, the seven deadly sins and how they were like marshaled to control women's behavior, like greed and pride and envy. I was trained not to have any of those and to constantly just be worrying about, am I doing it right? Am I being pleasing enough, keeping the rules, and do people like me? And so seeing that for me was mind-boggling and enraging, because I thought that was just being a good person. That was just being a good wife. That was just being a good Christian, a good mom, a good, you know, whatever. And so,
yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
So a metaphor that I like to use sometimes is that human beings are like sponges. We're just like sweet little sponges. And then whatever you put the sponge in, it's just going to absorb that, right? So if you are raised in a high demand religion, or even outside of a high demand religion, just with those same ideas that Sarah just mentioned, that's just what your sponge is going to absorb. And it's going to think it's reality because it's a sponge and it doesn't know, right? Like if you put a sponge in, like if you spill olive oil on your counter and use a sponge to wipe it up, the sponge is just going to absorb the olive oil. It doesn't have an opinion about it, right? It's like, okay, this is what we have. And if you put the sponge like in orange juice, it's just going to absorb the orange juice. Like it's just going to absorb whatever is there. And I think that's how brains are, right? And especially because like think about like humans as compared to other animals, we are so much more dependent as babies. Like a lot of animals are born and they can like walk in like a few hours or a few days. Humans are born and we're just like not doing a lot for like a while, right? So we rely on our caregivers so much. And I don't think any of us actually know who we would be and what we'd be capable of if we were raised from babyhood in certain different kinds of culture. And especially if like, can you imagine if there was no internet and it, like you never found out like that there were other ways of being, if all you've ever known is something, it's all you've ever known. Right. And so I think we need to have so much more grace with ourselves for how we were socialized, because like, that's just what your sponge had around it. And of course it was going to absorb it. You cannot put a dry sponge in liquid and have the sponge be like, I don't think so. This seems sus. That's not what sponges do. They just absorb it, right? And I mean, I think that's one of the things that's really interesting about being human, but I think it's also one of the things really hard about it, because most of us do have some beef with our parentals and with our culture and with other things about like what we learned. Like, I don't know any humans who don't have to do some unlearning, but on the other hand, pretty fucking cool that we can. Just because your sponge absorbed a bunch of orange juice doesn't mean you have to be orange juice forever, because coaching is essentially taking that sponge and running it through water and rinsing out what it learned and putting some soap on it and then rinsing it out some more. Like, we can't change the journey your sponge has already been on, but a sponge is magical in that it can release what it's absorbed and absorb something else. And when you see yourself as a sponge, it's so much easier not to like be mad at yourself for the things you absorbed. Like that literally you were designed to absorb. Like that's how babies learn, right? Yeah. If you put a baby somewhere and people are speaking French, that baby's going to learn French. You put a baby somewhere and people are doing a high demand religion, that baby's going to learn a high demand religion, right? That's like, that's what brains do.
Yeah.
Now, I do believe there's like a little bit of personality and some people might be a little more rebellious or a little more this and that, but that kind of that basic operating system is just going to be dropped in by what you're surrounded by. And so like being able to like not be so hard on ourselves if we're like, wow, why didn't I know better than to not to like absorb what my caregivers taught me? I'm like, well, you know, but this is, I think, one of the magical things about coaching is coaching. Like there's the past and a lot of us are like, ugh, but coaching is like, okay, but here we are now. What would you like to do? Right. Because I don't have a time machine. I'm very sorry. We can't go back and change the past, but what we can do is we can change the present and we can change what you're going to have access to in the future. And we can maybe even change some of your perspective on the past, even though we can't change the past itself. Like we can't undo the tumults and the journey that the sponge has already been on, but we can give that sponge a new lease on life and we can help it move into, I love this metaphor because it's like a sponge, but I'm like, we are sponges. Yeah.
We're sponges. But like
we can, you know, like anything's possible for you now, basically.
I love that metaphor. And so I'm thinking about, you know, someone who's listening to this, who identifies with the imposter syndrome mindset, like, who am I to say this? They're going to find out that I am not the most amazing, you know, ideal, whatever, whatever. What would you say to them? Like, just today?
Okay. So today, if you're like deep in imposter syndrome, you might not be able to move over into like, actually, I'm awesome. That's probably going to be too big of a stretch, right? In order to make change sustainable, we usually need to make it small. I call this just making it doable, right? So we just need to make it smaller steps. So if you're like, wow, I'm an imposter, like step one could just be like I was talking about before, like, well, did I lie to them? Did I lie to them about my education or like my background? Because like probably you didn't. And if you did, like, we're going to have a different conversation, but like, also if you did, like, wow, you're really good at being an imposter, like maybe celebrate that. But probably you didn't, right? Probably you have the degree you said you have, probably you have the experience you said you'd have, right? And so just moving from like what I'm going to call like the terrible story of imposter syndrome, that terrible, it's terrible because it makes you feel bad, right? Into just like the neutrality of like, well, what are actually the facts, right? Let's fact check this. Like, if you're like, I'm a fraud, it's like, well, is your CV full of lies? Probably not. It's probably actually accurate. But like, you're kind of have this idea of like, well, I have to be perfect to be good, right? That's not true. You didn't put on your CV, I'm perfect. You put on your CV, like, I went to this law school and then worked at this firm for 4 years, right? So I think just like remembering that, like, the bar is actually not be perfect. The bar is like, be a sort of average human who can do some things. Now, perfectionists hate this. I'm a recovering perfectionist myself, but perfectionism and imposter syndrome go together really tightly because imposter syndrome is often about like our inability to meet our exceptionally high standards versus like, usually we get hired to do a job because we can like basically do a thing, right? Like they don't actually need you to be perfect, right? So we go from our, you know, terrible story of imposter syndrome into our neutral story. And I would just hang out there for a while. And then after we hang out there for a while, we get sort of comfortable with this idea of like, yeah, I'm a lawyer. I said that and it's true. Now I'm just going to do some lawyer things. Then we can slowly move into building confidence. But usually we're not going to go from insecurity to confidence in one step. It'll feel too far and you'll boomerang back. And then you'll actually often feel more insecure and more impostery, right? So we're just going to kind of edge towards like what's true. And then we're going to begin to notice like the ways we're actually good at our job. But side by side with that, I would be holding that mental like awareness of like, oh, and maybe like my brain just wants to keep repeating the terrible story because I've literally been trained to be humble. And my brain's such a perfectionist that it took being humble too far all the way. Cause like, what is imposter syndrome, but humility that's like gotten a little too excited about itself. Right. And like, I do think for those of us who like I do have perfectionist-y tendencies. And so like, if I learned a lesson, like be humble, my brain would like, let's be really right. Let's be so humble. Right. Which is like,
we're going to be the best at being humble,
which is too much. Right.
Yeah.
Versus like, just like a little bit of that could be okay. But it's kind of like, I always wanted to get like get 105 on the test. Like that's literally more than 100%. Like we don't need extra credit in this. Maybe.
I love the distinction that you make between this like perfectionistic ideal, these exceptionally high standards that I tend to think of like, yeah, that's the ideal. If no mistakes happen, if everything goes exactly perfectly versus this is just what this job requires that I do. If it's a lawyer job, if it's a mom job, if it's a you know, teacher job, whatever, mm-hmm. I find that that is so true that we have this exceptionally high standards, impossible, you know, benchmarks, this ideal that we just keep moving toward that always just moves away from us and gets higher and higher and higher. We're never there. Like our brain never tells us, actually, you know what? You did reach the ideal. You did do it perfectly. And transitioning away, just noticing that thinking and transitioning away to like, what does the job that I was hired to do, if we're talking about career, or the job that I have before me, what does it require to do me to do that just means it's done and I've completed it?
Yeah. And so what I love to think about with this, and it makes my brain hurt and it makes all my clients' brains hurt, is lowering our standards for success while still allowing us to have really high standards for delight and what's possible. Because people like me, you know, and my clients were like, I'll be happy when, and then it's this like laundry list of things that like maybe could happen like once when all the stars align and everything comes together and the weather's perfect, right? And I'm like, yeah, my hair looks good. But like, I don't want to only be happy when the stars align and the weather's perfect and my hair looks good, because those, like, that's not that often. And I just don't think life is meant for us to feel like shit most of the time and then be happy like once a year. That's like, if you want to do it that way, I'm not here to stop you. You're in charge. It's your decision, but that's not what I want for myself. And so I realized like, oh, if my high standards are making me feel bad, maybe that's not what they're supposed to do. I actually have a whole Instagram thing about like, if your high standards make you feel bad and not want to do your goal, you're using high standards wrong. That's not what they're supposed to do, because it's not actually making your performance better. It's making you not do anything and then feel bad about yourself, right? So that's when I got into like, well, what if I could like way lower the standards, not so like everything can be like, bleh, but just so that I can get myself going. But I want to keep the high standards for like delight and what's possible and what could be interesting and what could be fun. Like, but like, I want to allow kind of that space to be like, this is like where I get to be creative and it's interesting. And like, ooh, wouldn't it be cool if my hair did look good and the weather was nice and the same? I mean, that would be fun. I like that too. But like, what if I can lower like, okay, like I answered some emails and did my coaching calls. That's success. At the lower bar of like, I did it.
Yeah.
Right.
And then getting to experience the satisfaction of, I did it. I did it. Letting it count. Yeah. That's how I talk letting about it a lot. Is like letting it count. It's like, we only let the final perfect product count instead of all of the success and all the obstacles we worked through and all of the things that we did on the way. And it provides such a limited experience, like you said, for pleasure and satisfaction and feeling really like, yes, I did it. I did the thing. And so I love that shift.
You know what it's like? It's like enjoying your marriage versus enjoying your wedding. Your wedding, I've never been married, but like, it's funny because I've never had a wedding, but I basically have a marriage because my significant other and I are very like partnered. We're very together. She's divorced and she didn't want to get remarried. And I used to think like, oh, we're going to have a wedding. I'll talk you into it. And then eventually I was like, I don't even like big parties. Why would I do that? Why would I do that? Because I've been socialized to want a wedding since I was a baby, like asterisk. But to move back to the metaphor, it's like a wedding is like one day people put so much pressure on it. Their hair has to look perfect. The weather has to be perfect. Their dress has to be perfect. Like everyone has to behave perfectly. Da, 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 da. And it's like so much pressure. But a marriage is every day. It's, you know, Alex and I both had COVID over Christmas. So it's like, now we both have COVID. Can that also be part of the fabric of our wonderful life? Like, yeah. I want a wonderful life. And to me, that does often involve embracing ups and downs and learning to like enjoy moments that are imperfect, because that's all of them.
Yeah.
That's all of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So I love what we have covered. This is just kind of how my brain thinks. And so I'm going to summarize it this way. So when we see that we have literally been trained to think this way, it can offer us options for opening up that thinking. And I love how you said transitioning from imposter syndrome straight to, of course I belong here. Yes, I'm the most confident woman in the room. Isn't likely. And so to spend some time first in recognizing the socialization and just seeing that actually I didn't lie. I am, you know, whether it's the a job you've been hired to do or a job that you're just doing, I am qualified to do this. Interesting that my brain kind of tries to make me think that I am not. and hanging out in the neutrality of just recognizing that there are things that are factually true that I wrote down on my resume and have a, as a part of my CV. And my brain continually wants to discount that and not let it count.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then once we spend some time there, like, what is, in your opinion, the switch into seeking confidence and like really feeling the confidence that so many women don't feel like they have access to?
Mm-hmm. Well, as you were like kind of reviewing the things we talked about, I realized like another thing, another element that I'm like, oh, this is actually, I think, really helpful, is realizing that for a lot of us, especially like those of us who are knowledge workers, we're not hired to know exactly what to do. We're hired to be able to figure it out. Right. So if you go in and you're like, I didn't lie about my job experience, but I have this assignment and I don't know, then yeah, it's remembering that, like, yeah, you're supposed to not know, because they didn't, like, very rarely anymore do we get hired to do things we 100% know how to do. Some people do, right? If you're a master electrician, you probably know how to do it. Honestly, I don't know. Maybe they don't either. I'm not a master electrician, obviously. But like, even for me, for coaching, it's like I get a new client and I don't know what we're like, I know the tools I have, but then I have to like get to know them and figure out how the tools apply to them. And then how are we going to like move through the things, and how are we going to get to where we want to go? And if you're a lawyer, you might have worked at one kind of firm and you might work somewhere else, but like, don't discount what you do have. Cause I think that's what makes us feel so miserable, is we discount what we do have. And a lot of this is also just because human brains have negativity bias. Like, in addition to like the way we're socialized and all this other stuff, we also have negativity bias. So our brain really wants to hyper-focus on what's not working or what also like might go wrong later. And it can feel actually very bizarre and uncomfortable to like notice what is working and like what we do have. Your brain's like, yeah, I don't care about that. I care about these threats over here. So there is also a little bit of training of like, the brain is naturally like Velcro for what's not working, and it's like Teflon for what is. And so one of the things I work on with my clients also is just like paying attention to and acknowledging what's working and going well. Now, again, if that feels too far for you, you might have to stop through on neutral. So that could just be like acknowledging what's neutral, like acknowledging what's neither good nor bad, right? Like, oh, they gave me this assignment, I don't know how to do it. Okay, but like, did I learn how to do assignments in my last job? I did learn how to do assignments in my last job, right?
Yeah. And so the chances are, I'm going to be able to figure this one out too.
Yeah. And also it's like, and you're not in a vacuum. You actually have resources. It's interesting. Like, when we feel imposter syndrome, we often also lock ourselves down because we're afraid of being found out. We think we have to know everything, and then we don't ask other people. Whereas when we feel kind of more like, I know some stuff and don't know some stuff, and that's normal and how everyone is, then we're also like, you know what? I should probably talk to Gail or Martine, right? I should talk to somebody and like they can help me figure out the pieces I don't know, because of course I don't know some pieces I'm supposed to. Like, in a meeting, usually the person who's willing to say, I don't know, is actually like the most confident person, right? Yes. And I remember really like taking that to heart when I worked in corporate tech and realizing like, if I don't know, maybe a bunch of other people don't know. And then just beginning to ask questions that I was afraid were really obvious, but oftentimes a lot of other people also don't know. So there's also an element, I think, too, of like where imposter syndrome is comparing your inside experience to what you observe about others, but you don't know. It's possible, like a lot of other people in the room also feel uncertain, right? But if you're like kind of trying to hide your own uncertainty, you might miss out on that chance to connect with them.
Which just further marginalizes you, right? The hiding and the withdrawing that is so normal when you feel exposed or overly like they're going to find out, I hide, I withdraw, I protect. And I think that just contributes to further discounting, counting yourself isolating. Yeah. And then inside my brain, what my brain tells me is, see, you were right. You were right to think that you shouldn't be the one speaking up. You were right to think that you don't have enough, you know, to figure this out or to make this happen.
Mm.
Please tell me, I just saw a big idea in your brain.
Yes. I don't want to load y'all down with too many big ideas. But the other big idea is, I think there's also something that happens about whether your belief in yourself is like rigid or flexible, because rigid things shatter, right? If your belief in yourself and your like confidence is like rigid and it can't fluctuate with knowing and not knowing, then if you come across some not knowing, your self-confidence may shatter and then you don't have any. Whereas if your confidence in yourself is like flexible and you're like, I'm really good at some stuff. And also I don't know everything. And like, then sometimes I become good at other things. And then I ask questions and it's okay if I don't know, that's flexible. And it's kind of like bridges are built so that they can wiggle with the wind, which if you think about that while you're driving over wind, that seems scary. Cause I'm like, please don't wiggle. I would not like that to happen, but that's actually what makes it safe. Right. So if bridges get to wiggle, maybe you can too. Right. If bridges get to wobble, maybe you can too. And maybe that like rigid, like have it all together, I got it. If that's what makes bridges fall down, maybe that's not helpful for you either.
Yeah. I love the idea of the flexibility of that you're talking about, because what I find, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, is that when someone has a very rigid, like, I have to know everything, I have to, and their trust is in more of like, which, oh gosh, it's just such a mind fuck, because we are programmed as women that to speak up, we have to be so well-researched. We have to have all of our reasons. We have to present these bulletproof arguments that, that no one can disagree with. Otherwise we didn't really know everything that we, present can be questioned. And then it's about us not being good enough to even take up space and have an opinion. So on the one hand, we have to see that programming. Like I have been programmed that unless I really know my shit, I shouldn't speak up. But on the other hand, that's so rigid. And the flexibility to believe I can figure this out. And if I make mistakes along the way to figuring that out, I am not going to beat myself up for that. That's where I see so like the risk averseness of women is, I don't know. I need to figure it out. I'm going to start taking some steps in this direction. And if I fuck it up, I'm going to be really, really mean to myself about it. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of locks them in this place of indecision, overthinking, and overwhelm.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the myths there is that you can get anywhere in life without making mistakes, which I just don't think is true. Right. But if you think you're not only can you, but you're supposed to do it without mistakes, and then you have one, then of course, shame attack.
Yes.
Retreat. Yeah. But if you're like, obviously getting anywhere in life requires, like, I just like to make up stats sometimes. Don't worry. I don't pretend that they're real. I like tell people like, but like, so let's just make up the statistic that to get to any goal, it's going to take at least 10 mistakes, right? Then you're like, great, I had a mistake. I'm going like, right. It's like, think about like a baby learning to walk. They usually have some wobbles, right? They fall down. Or like learning to drive a car. You didn't just get in a car and know how to drive it. Like I remember getting in a car and it was a stick shift and it had three pedals. And I was just like, what the fuck is this? I just was like, get me back out of the car. Right. Like I thought it would be two pedals. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like, we're not supposed to learn without mistakes. Like mistakes are actually supposed to happen. And it's not like I think they're a super fun time. It's not like I'm like, actually really enjoy them that much. But when I can accept and tolerate them as part of the path to getting what I want versus evidence that I'm a fuck up, then I'm able to like, I'm again, it's that flexibility. I'm able to like allow them into the experience. Maybe I have to go in a bathroom and lock the door and cry a little because like I'm a huge crier. I'm a very big feeler. Right. And, but like, it's not evidence that I'm flawed. It's evidence that I'm doing something. Right. Growing often requires messing up. Like, do I wish it wasn't so? Sure. I don't conveniently have a magic fairy wand I can wave though. So like, this is what we're working with. Right. Yes. And the more that mistakes make you feel terrible, the more you're going to hide them and not be willing them to have in public. You're allowed to do it that way, but it's going to slow you down significantly. Now, yes. I'm still mindful about it. There's some mistakes that I'm like, that seems a little bit big. I'm willing to go slower to like maybe have a slightly smaller mistake that like it's a little bit like what's your tolerance, right? Like what's your risk tolerance? What's your mistake tolerance? But growing your mistake tolerance can grow. It can like speed things up for you. And that can be fun because then you can start to like, even if you don't like the mistakes, you can see them as evidence that like you're taking big swings.
Yes.
You're trying and you're moving forward.
Yeah. I have loved everything that we have talked about. And what I hope is for people listening, you can take one or two ideas and just put them in your back pocket, pull them out, look at them and think about like, what if I really just am programmed to think this way? What would change if I really truly believed my thoughts about myself are not ones I came up with in some vacuum, right? It's right. So informed by the way that we grew up in this Western capitalistic patriarchal society. What if that's really true? And one of my favorite questions that, you know, you and I have both worked with and for Cara, and Cara Lowenstein, why did I just forget her last name?
Lowenthal.
Thank you. I'm like, what is happening? And she asked the question, like when a woman is detailing all the ways in which her brain tells her she's wrong, she will say, well, does your brain ever tell you you're right? Does your brain ever? And that question was like, it blew it wide open for me. Cause like, isn't that interesting? My brain just will tell me all day long that I got it wrong. It never tells me that I got it right. And so just taking one or two little things that could blow this open for you. That's what I hope. Corey, Lynn, what do you hope for people?
I just hope that there's something in here that like helps untangle the knot, whatever the knot is for you. Like, I just hope there's something that like wiggles things and makes you see things even slightly differently, even 1 degree differently, where you're like, wait a minute, maybe I can have like a business. Maybe I could have a different kind of relationship with my significant other. Maybe I could parent differently. Like maybe I could get promoted. Maybe I could actually be a really good CEO, right? And just like, just wiggling things, even just a little bit, because little bit by little bit is how every big thing gets done. Also, I have a fun and special prize for your people. I have a workbook. It's called The Satisfied AF Audit, and it helps you go through your life and figure out exactly like what's working and what's not working in each area. And people who've done this before have actually told me it makes them feel so good and so much like there's often so much more satisfaction in their life than they thought. So I think that's also a great way to wiggle things forward and shift out of imposter syndrome into like a delicious, delighted, yummy version of your life. And so Sarah's going to include that for you in the show notes as well. So if you thought that the conversation here was interesting, that's also a way you can take the work deeper.
I love it. And I'm so grateful. People, maybe they know, but I know the work that goes into putting things like that together, where you distill like years and years of work that you've spent working with clients and taking big concepts and trying to break them open, make them accessible. And so I'm so grateful that you would offer that. Is there anything else that you wanted to say about imposter syndrome or add to this conversation that you didn't get a chance to yet?
Well, I think this is something we kind of hinted at, but just I want to say really directly, no matter what liquid your sponge has been soaking in, no matter what life experiences you've been having, no matter what your internal experience is like, no matter what your, you know, socialization was, you can change it. You have so much power at this moment and moving forward. And you are not stuck with the experiences you've had heretofore. They're going to be part of your life, but you can make big and small changes. And I think that's so fun and exciting.
I love it. I'm so glad you said that. And it's the perfect place to end for today. Thanks, Corey Lynn.
You are so welcome.
Hey, thanks for listening. If this podcast has been helpful to you, I would really appreciate it if you would give me a 5-star rating in whatever platform you listen to your podcast. And if you go to my website, sarahfisk.coach, you can sign up there to receive my emails. Right now, I'm taking private one-to-one clients who want my help speeding up this work in their own lives.
I really hope to provide a lot of free information on my website and in my podcast for people to do this work on their own. But if you're interested in having a coach like me to help you implement these things faster, to find the blind spots and obstacles that you're not aware of, go to my website and sign up for a consult. That's a time when you and I can get on Zoom and talk about the particulars of your situation, and I can show you how I could be helpful. The second thing you can do on my website is sign up for a freebie that I have called Difficult Conversations. Having a conversation that seems like it's going to be hard or difficult is one of the things that people pleasers struggle with. And so I've created a whole guide for you to be able to do that with some more confidence. That will also get you signed up for information about my group program, Stop People Pleasing, which is coming again at the end of April, beginning of May. And it's a group coaching program where you join a community of women just like you who are struggling to overcome perfectionating and people pleasing. And we do it together in a group. It's a really amazing opportunity to not just learn from your own experience, but just to see how similar you are to so many other women out there. The healing and the challenging and the laughing and the growth that happens in that beautiful community of women is really amazing. And if it's interesting to you, I would love for you to know about it. Thanks again for listening.